supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hello and welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, stepping in briefly for host Mike McGrath while he enjoys some well-deserved vacation. But we will be busy going back and enjoying some of our most interesting interviews in another brand new summer special edition of You Bet Your Garden. Joining me is associate producer Brett Rader, who's been helping me find some great interviews and past questions of the week. Brett, thank you as always, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Alexis. Happy to be here.
Glad you're with us. We're going to start off the show with a conversation Mike had with Dr. Hazel Barton back in 2012 about bats and what an incredible eater of pest insects they are. Unfortunately, they are facing some challenges. Let's find out more.
Dr. Barton, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you for being here. For those of our listeners who might be curious as to why we're talking to someone about bats on the show, the answer from a gardener's perspective is that if there were no bats on this planet, my understanding is we would be overwhelmed with pest insects.
We would, actually. Somebody has calculated the economic impact of that and the impact it could have in America. And if you include industrial agriculture, you're looking at up to $57 billion of impact. And that impact is reflected in people having to use more pesticides, paying more money, and also the loss of plants as a result of that. It's really interesting to think about the impact of bats. I think that's something people don't think about. They often do think about mosquitoes, and obviously there's a human impact there with potential transmission of diseases such as West Nile virus. But a bat biologist told me one time that mosquitoes are like popcorn for bats. So we might eat popcorn, but we don't go out of our way to eat it. It's just if it's there, we might grab a handful. And bats are like that with mosquitoes. If they're flying around and they grab one, they'll just kind of pop it in their mouth, but there's not a lot of nutritional value. But a moth, I mean, a nice, big, fat, juicy moth for a bat, that's a fairly good meal. And a single bat, a single female bat who has got young, she can eat up to 2,700 moths in a night.
2,700?
100, yeah. Especially when she's getting ready to go into hibernation, she can eat her own body weight.
I want to go to the dollar store and get one of those little fake tin cups that says world's number one mom and give it to that bat. I mean, that's an enormous number of garden and agricultural pests that never get to be born.
Right. Yeah, when you think about, you know, how many eggs does a single moth lay? I think they can lay several hundred in one go. So that's a lot of caterpillars.
And, of course, there are enormous diversity of bats around the world. I guess where you are in Ohio is pretty much the same kind of bat population that we have here in Pennsylvania and the rest of the East Coast, and that's a big percentage of our bats are the little brown bat, right?
Correct. I believe within the East Coast area, and that's primarily looking at the Appalachian Mountain region, that seems to be a good boundary for them. There, I believe they estimate there's about 9 million little brown bats. But that number has pretty much been decimated. We're anticipating that species will go extinct in our region by 2020.
No, I mean, that's tomorrow.
Yeah, and people already are seeing impacts of that. I mean, people, they do tend to notice the mosquitoes more because obviously if something bites you on your arm, you're going to notice that. But, you know, I have friends who live in areas of West Virginia and Kentucky that have been impacted. And they're like, you know, I've noticed there's a lot more mosquitoes than there were last year.
And what I realize this is the basis of your research. This is the basis of your talk. I think everyone has become aware that there is a fungus that's affecting hibernating bats. Give us the short take on what this does to the bats and what we know about it.
Well, it's a devastating disease. It really affects the bats when they're in hibernation. It's called white nose syndrome because a bat that has it looks like its nose is being dumped in powdered sugar. And so it has this white nose. And the impact of this organism would be very similar to having athlete's foot. So if you can imagine you're trying to sleep, but your entire face is covered with athlete's foot, it's going to disturb you. And a bat that would normally stay in torpor for, you know, 14 days, we're seeing them wake up every other day or every 2 days. So it doesn't take long for them to eventually starve to death.
Now, these bats are native species, right? They've been here for thousands of years, and they've been observed carefully by humans for hundreds of years. Where did this thing come from? Why? What happened?
We think that this is an old world disease. So this would be akin to smallpox coming to the Americas with Columbus and crew. So as a new world species, so a species of the Americas, they're not, they haven't adapted to and they're not resistant to these new pathogens that get introduced.
But are you implying that there are European bats that have evolved to have a natural immunity to this disorder?
It's been seen in a number of countries, primarily in France. I believe it's also been found in Germany and Romania. And there is a syndrome that looks very much like white nose syndrome in bats in France. They wake up, they wipe it off their face, and they carry on as if nothing's happened. They do behave slightly differently than North American bats. North American bats will hibernate in very large clusters. It's amazing to go into a hibernaculum, an area where bats hibernate, and you can see 5,000 individuals in a patch that you could stretch your arms across. So they cluster very tightly together. And the problem with that is if somebody comes in who's sick, everybody in that group will get sick too. Whereas in Europe, they tend to hibernate on their own, maybe one or two bats. So if one guy gets sick, he's only going to make his neighbor sick. He's not going to infect everybody around him. So that might be one of the issues we're seeing. The other is we do actually see species that are more resistant to it in North America, and they like to hibernate in slightly different conditions. It looks like the fungus likes it to be nice and moist and humid, and some bats don't like that. They like to hibernate in drier conditions. And those bats don't seem to be as affected. And so that's another potential mechanism the bats in Europe have used. So they've developed almost an avoidance mechanism. Their behavior has changed to make them less susceptible to the fungus.
Is it possible that they used to behave like our bats? And as you said, they've developed this avoidance behavior, you know, because you paint a bleak picture hearing that it came from the old world. I had all these hopes that we could, you know, isolate a cure and, you know, treat some of our bats and have them pass on the immunity. But do you think that over time, the best hope is that different survivors will develop different ways of hibernating, that it'll just be this small subculture of loners, loner bats that carry on the DNA of this remarkable creature?
I think that's what we're really realistically looking at. We've tried very hard. This was first seen in 2006, and we've tried everything. It's been so aggressive in the response, especially from the federal agencies and the state. Pennsylvania Game Commission has just been fantastic in the way they've dealt with this. So it's been very aggressive, but I think it's Mother Nature, and she's got the best solution, and that is looking for these communities that have natural resistance and change their behavior.
Now, let's bring this back to the garden. I didn't really expect you to talk about the clustering of the bats, the massive density being part of the problem with the little brown bat. But is this something now that gardeners might be able to have a positive influence on? A lot of gardeners are tremendously interested in bat houses, learning the correct type of construction, erecting them near the garden. Could people who put up the correct type of bat houses, I understand you need to know what you're doing, but any bat house is going to have many fewer bats than a giant cave full. Could this be a way to accelerate the development of a resistant population?
I think that would be a fantastic solution. Building a bat house is a real trick, and Bat Conservation International has a little leaflet you can download from the internet on how to build them and the tricks you can have, like take some guano and rub it on the inside so the bats are more likely to populate it. But I think that's a fantastic solution. But what people can do in the winter is if they see unusual bat behavior, they see bats flying around maybe when it's cold and there's snow on the ground, or a bat maybe flapping around on the ground that really is behaving the way that bats shouldn't behave, and they alert the state authorities, either the Division of Wildlife or the Game Commission. If they do that, they can have a profound impact because it can help us track the progression of where this pathogen, this fungus is moving, and help us take steps so we can alert people. We can try to block human behaviors that might promote the spread of the organism. We don't yet know if humans are involved, but certainly with other diseases like foot and mouth disease, if you see that in Europe, it's very easily spread by human activity. So what we can do is we can go in and try to mitigate some of the problems best we can. Anything you can do to create a habitat for a bat is a fantastic thing to do for bats in general.
Dr. Barton, keep up the good work, and let's all hope for a miracle with the little brown bat.
Thank you. I think we all are hoping for that.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring some of our most interesting interviews from past shows, selected and introduced by our producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. Coming up next, safer birds, happier chickens, and tremendous toads. I'm playing hooky down ashore, Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, helping Mike McGrath out today by introducing some of our favorite interviews from the last couple of years. Helping me do this is associate producer Brett Rader. Coming up, you'll hear Mike's conversation with inventor Jeff Akopian, who came up with an amazing solution to bird collisions into windows. And Brett, I don't know if you've seen this before, but I've seen a bird do this only once, and it was really heartbreaking, and we get so many calls about it. I remember when this interview first aired, and there was a huge response. You know, people were so interested in the product Jeff is talking about, and he's designed a really unique and attractive way to protect these wonderful birds, which you just don't see anywhere else. So it's a really unique conversation.
Yeah, fortunately, I haven't seen this firsthand. I think probably the most distress I've seen a bird in is being stuck in an IKEA or something. But I do hear about it all the time. It's definitely a problem.
It really is. So what I found so interesting is that Jeff and his family back in the 80s used their naturalist and engineering backgrounds to come up with this idea. And you can still find the product offered at birdsavers.com.
All right, Alexis, before we get distracted by all these dangly, shiny things in the studio, let's get to it.
Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
This is really important. I couldn't believe that we had not done a question of the week on bird collisions because we do hear from listeners about it all the time. And it's a very common problem that you seem to have developed a very simple, low-tech solution to. But let's drop back to the simple topic of why do birds fly into windows, and are some windows more likely to suffer bird collisions?
Yeah, basically, windows act like mirrors. And so the birds see the outside in the mirror in the window, and they think that they can fly through it. So they fly into, they'll see a tree in the window, and they'll fly in through the tree and hit the window.
And they don't slow down, though, what I've noticed.
No. They might slow down if they happen to see something that clues them that it's not a window or it's not the outside. But no, they smash into it full speed.
And my understanding is this is a huge problem when you look at the totality of the country, that this happens too frequently.
It happens a lot. A lot.
And as our listeners know, I'm a huge advocate of populating your landscape with birds because this is something that's been forgotten in the modern world of gardening. A lot of people only think of birds as pests because they'll steal their cherries or they'll share their blueberries or a couple of other things. But I was always struck when I would see a turn-of-the-century gardening book or a gardening book or a farming book from the teens or 20s. Almost always there would be a chapter on attracting the farmer's friend, which was different birds that would come in and eat pest insects for the farmer. It was a vital part of pest control.
Yes, definitely.
Now, what got you involved in trying to come up with a simple solution to window collisions? Because, you know, if you go online, there's 800 different tricks people can do, putting up Halloween spider webs, hanging CDs in
their
window.
And they're all pretty ugly looking, and a lot of them don't even work. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, we realized that birds were killing themselves in our windows at our house. And we decided to, we're a family of engineers and naturalists. We decided to...
That's a good combination right here, right?
We decided to try to figure out how we can stop this from happening because they were always unusual birds like cuckoos and flickers. And what we did is we took those beads that hang, if you remember from back then...
I just had a flashback.
Those beads that hang in the windows. We took them apart and we hung them about every 4 inches outside the window. And lo and behold, it stopped the birds from colliding with the windows.
So, but you had hippies walking up to your
house
all the time.
We did have hippies walking around, yes. A couple of us lived in the house, actually. But anyway, so that solved the problem for years and years and years. And then a few years later, we started a book on the birds of Armenia. We started writing a book on the birds of Armenia. And we collaborated with this fellow in Muhlenberg College, Dan Clem, who, as it happened, very unusual, he was studying birds colliding with windows. So I thought we were the only ones with this problem of having the birds collide with the windows. He said it's a major problem all over the place. So after years of him telling me this, I decided, well, geez, I should make this technique available to everyone. So I made a website, birdsavers, plural, birdsavers.com, and it tells you on there how you can make this yourself. It's just paracord, nylon paracord, eighth-inch diameter. They're hung about, you hang them about 4 inches apart on the outside of the window, and the birds basically see the cords before they fly into the window. And it works. And it's been scientifically tested.
So you couldn't find the old hippie beads anymore?
You couldn't find the old hippie beads anymore, and this is before the internet, so you couldn't search for them. So actually what we did after the hippie beads is we got thin bamboo strips. We'd hung those, but they were really ugly looking.
Mm-hmm.
But this paracord looks great. People love the way it looks. Some people like it. They don't even know that it's protecting the birds from hitting the windows, and they like it.
Now, you're calling this paracord.
Parachute cord.
Parachute cord. Yes. Oh, okay. Yes. And is that what it is?
That is parachute cord. As a matter of fact, this particular—
So this stuff is indestructible.
It's indestructible, yeah. It's actually made at the same place that makes the paracord that they use to land the Curiosity lander on Mars.
Oh, wow. Cord,
which is up in Telford, Pennsylvania.
I should treat this stuff with more respect.
Right.
I should
but
say
you don't
that—
need, you don't need special cord. You just need anything. Paracord is the best thing that works. It lasts for a long time and it looks good.
Jeff has brought in some of his manufactured product, and this parachute cord, it's like a lanyard. It's like the stuff, you know, when you go to a business meeting now, since we later found out that you really can ruin suits by putting those stick-on labels on, everybody right. gets these little lanyard-type things. And this is the kind of cord right. you see on those things. And the color is like a military greenish
green. Olive drab, they call it.
Right, olive drab. I should have known that. And I'm guessing that that's the most invisible color.
Well, I think that any color will work, to tell you the truth. But the
invisible, I mean, not to the birds, but to the homeowner.
Right. We also think the same thing. We think that it looks the best. That's why we use that color.
And you were kind enough. You asked me if I have any windows that birds flew into. And, you know, I don't know if it's a coincidence, or I don't know if, unfortunately, almost everybody who lives in the woods
That's right.
probably has this problem. My office looks out onto a grove of trees and a beautiful stream, and thank goodness it does not happen very often. But sometimes I'll be sitting there typing, lost in thought, and I'll hear this boom, and I'll look up to see this explosion of feathers. Now, thankfully, I don't know what it is about my layout, but luckily the impacts have only been cartoon. At best, I have gotten out of my chair, run down outside the house, and saw a bird kind of pulling itself up and staggering around and then looking at me and saying, you know, who drove that truck? And then it flies away. I've never had the right. horror of having to pick up and dispose of a dead one. And it doesn't happen all that often. But you were kind enough to make these, and I will go back and hang them in my windows. And what it is, you've given me the instructions here. It's made to the width of my window.
The nice thing about bird savers is that anybody can make them.
We're going to get to that. Okay. We're going to get to that. But you have four clamps that'll hold it in place, and What do they claim? Oh, they've got Velcro
on them?
We've got
two different kinds for the ones we make. It's either Velcro, but they don't last as long. After a year, two or three,
right.
the weather might, they might deteriorate. Or you can just put them in with little screws and clamps.
Okay, and it's adapted to either one.
Yep.
And they're little metal tags that, you know, remind you of the manufacturer, Ecopian Bird Savers, in case you want to, you know, you want to replace them or tell your friends
right,
about them.
But you don't
them.
Get those if you have the clamps because there's no place to put it. It's so small. So.
Okay. You can't put the wording on those.
Right.
And then it goes across the top of your window. And how many cords hang down? How often?
That depends. About every four and a quarter inches. So it depends on how wide your window is.
Right.
We custom make them for your window.
And the cords, the color of these cords that hang down on the window, remind me so much of Robert Benner's Invisible Deer Fence material, in that the coloration is supposed to blend in with the woods when you're looking out.
Right.
But obviously you've tested these because
yes.
you're an engineer and you don't know how to live any other way, right?
That's correct.
And was this color the most effective, the most easy for homeowners to accept? Was it a blend?
I think it's the only one.
Or was it simply the color of the best, strongest, longest-lasting material?
No, it just is the nicest color for not bothering your eye when you're looking at it. That's what we think, and that's what everyone who has them thinks. So,
because, again, some of the internet and pass along things or to hang CDs in the window.
Yeah, but who wants CDs hanging off their window?
Well, not only that, but they're constantly banging against the window.
This is very interesting because you tell people you're hanging strings in front of your windows, and it's like, ew. But then when people actually see it, that's not their reaction at all. had one young lady, she said that she can't wait to buy a house so she can put these on the windows because they had a calming effect on her.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
Well, there's nothing less calming than having a bird bounce off
that's
your window
true.
While
you
got a glass of wine at the end of the day watching the sunset and Woody Woodpecker takes
it really,
a header.
It really stinks when the birds kill themselves in your windows.
One thing that I have done that we do have a question of the week about was a mistake I made ages ago on the show. We had, I guess it was a call or maybe it was something else, but they had woodpeckers pecking away at the side of their house. And I had learned erroneously years ago that the woodpeckers were searching for bugs in the wooden siding.
They might be trying to make a house in there.
That is exactly what they were doing because then we would hear from more people and go, guess what? Once they got through the T11, they started ripping out the insulation. Right. That's when I started to talk to real ornithologists and find out that, no, the woodpeckers are actually going to build a nest in the side of your house, and it's going to get really foul. They are really known for fouling their nest. They'll only use a nest once for one season, and then they go away because it's like a college dorm in there when they leave. And one of the solutions was actually to put birdhouses out there for them.
Well, that definitely, yeah.
But you had to fill them with cedar chips because they have to excavate because they're thinking it's a hollow tree and they got to dig some stuff out. So you have to give them a house that's full that they can empty, then they'll move in. The other solution was remarkably similar to yours. It involved fishing line hung across the length of, in this case, not the windows, the entire outside of the house, with little weights, slugs at the bottom, little metal slugs to hold it down. And it was clear, and it was strung along every couple of inches, and when the woodpecker would land, there would be this weird thing in its way, and they would not build their nest.
There's actually one company that makes something to keep birds from flying into the windows that's made from monofilament line, but it hasn't been tested, so we don't really know if it works. We know this one works.
Right, because the monofilament line with the woodpeckers, it allowed them to land on the side of the house, but then have these funky things pulling at their, quote, shoulders all the time and not allowing them to be comfortable enough to start excavating. But I would think a truly clear, invisible fishing line wouldn't achieve what you need to give the bird a visual.
I would think the same thing. That's why the people who make that, they should really have it tested because they claim it works, but I don't really know.
Where have your products been tested?
Oh, well, there's a fellow, like I mentioned earlier, Dan Clem. He's the authority on this.
He said Muhlenberg.
And Muhlenberg, yeah. He's the go-to guy for testing products for the windows that keep birds from flying into it.
And Muhlenberg is a well-known university in the Lehigh Valley.
Yes, it's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. But these are many places. There's some out in a USDA facility in Maricopa, Arizona. We sent them a bunch, and now they're making their own. And they told me an interesting story. They said all of a sudden, a place where they had bird savers, one of the birds started hitting the windows again, and they went and looked at it, and what happened was part of the bird savers fell down, and where they fell down, that's where the birds were hitting the windows again.
So that's like double proof.
Yeah, they work. They work.
And one of the things that enticed me to have you on the show, because obviously you have a little company that makes these and stuff, but what I found remarkable is you really try to talk people out of buying them from you.
I'd rather they make them themselves because there's all kinds of people out there, and it's so simple to make. You know, gardeners, they don't want to buy something. They want to make something. Well, but if they want to make it, they can order them from us, and we'll make them.
That's not necessarily true, but I can tell you it's true about every engineer I ever met, Jeff. And you know they're going to try to, well, this could be a little bit better
that's
here.
Good. Or, that's good.
You know. So that's great. I mean, you have a company that tells people to make it themselves.
Right.
And has all the instructions they need.
All the stuff is on the website, how to make them.
And the website is birdsavers.com.
Birdsavers with an S, plural, yeah.
That's pretty easy to remember. Well, this is great. I will have to keep this in mind. And the fact that you are really telling people don't buy it from me if you can't, you know, if you don't have opposable thumbs or something like that. But otherwise, here's how to make it yourself. Mm-hmm. It's not that bad. And, boy, we could save a lot of birds.
We could.
If people did this. And you're going to save a lot of birds after today. So, Jeff Akopian, inventor of the Akopian Bird Savers, thanks very much for being on the show, but thank you even more for taking this problem seriously and finding a solution to it that's so easy that anybody can do.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks very much.
And once again, that website is birdsavers.com. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce my personal appearances for this fall. I'll be at the Ludington Library in Lower Merion on Wednesday evening, October 4th, at the Lower Makefield Township Building on Saturday, October 28th, and I'll deliver the keynote address at the Phipps Conservatory and Botanic Gardens in Pittsburgh during their annual Native Plant and Sustainability Conference on Saturday, October 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more excellent interviews selected and introduced by producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're in the stretch now. That's our engineer's favorite part. He's clapping in the control room. I'm producer Alexis Landis, looking back at some of our most engaging interviews with my fearless co-host, associate producer Brett Rader. Coming up, Mike talks with Adam Glass, a farmer and gardener, about keeping backyard chickens.
I'm not too sure I'd want chickens in my backyard.
Oh, come on, Brett. I know you're a city dweller, but you'd be amazed how good fresh eggs taste. Mm. And the chickens are mighty cute. In fact, my neighbor has a chicken coop in his backyard. I do live in the suburbs, of course. But my four-year-old loves watching them peck at the ground and meander through the yard. He's always asking to pet them. Maybe not the greatest idea. Although my dog had to be kept on a tight leash for sure.
And if that's not enough, stay with us because Mike will tell us how to attract frogs and toads to our landscape. That's a lot to get done, but first let's find out what it's like to have your very own backyard chickens.
Now it is time to welcome our guest, Adam Glass, a gardener at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College. And he's here because we can't get enough information about chickens. Chickens are hot today. Adam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And do you agree with me? How hot are chickens in the world today?
They're a hot topic. Everybody who is into gardening and, you know, raising their own food is all about chickens these days.
I'm going to be perfectly honest and say that although I've been a gardener for well over 30 years now, I've never even been tempted to keep my own chickens. I can barely keep my vegetables in line, much less something that's going to be moving around. And I've always worried about predators because I live out in the country, in the woods. Is that one of the biggest things that people need to pay attention to, is the fact that almost every creature on the planet that eats other creatures finds chickens very tasty, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, one of those things that you have to make sure you're putting them up at night so that, you know, fox and skunk and, you know, raccoons and possums, all those guys, they love chickens and eggs, and given the opportunity, they're gonna take advantage of it. So it's definitely one of the big concerns that you have to keep an eye out for and make sure that you're keeping your chickens safe, especially in the evening.
And it's really hard to outwit a raccoon, right? They are big and powerful, but they can make themselves small, and they're very smart.
Yeah, they're absolutely persistent, and if they put their mind to it, they'll get in there. So you really have to make sure that your coop is secure and that, you know, you're keeping an eye on things and checking things and making sure that, you know, you're keeping them safe at all times.
Now, during the day when they're out running around, there are fewer predators out. But I would presume you are going to hope that people keep them fenced in to some degree?
Yeah, yeah. With all these people coming to, you know, want have chickens in their backyard, a lot of townships and municipalities are really putting ordinances into effect that, you know, the chickens have to be in a certain sort of enclosure at all times. They're typically not allowed to free range if you live in a, you know, more urban environment. Luckily, I live in the country where my chickens can run free, but, you know, you do have to be aware of predators during the day as well, hawks especially.
I was going to say, I actually witnessed a hawk attack where the hawk went through screening. So what do you tell people? I mean, does it, you know, when somebody wants to set up a small flock? And what is a small flock? How many chicks do you buy?
I would say probably 5 to 6 is a good number for a small backyard. You know, they definitely need a certain amount of space. It's about 5 square feet per chicken of outdoor space that they need. So, you know, just depending on the amount of space you have, you want to make sure you can accommodate them.
And does almost everyone buy chicks that have been professionally started?
Yeah, most amateurs will buy chicks. It's the easiest way to start them. You know, incubating eggs is kind of a scientific and technical process that cannot be so successful. So, yeah.
So it's like a corollary to starting seeds. You're a gardener at the Scott Arboretum out at Swarthmore College. And you probably know as well as I do, and many of our listeners who've tried it, there's almost no correlation between gardening and seed starting. They're totally different arts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I can imagine taking an egg and getting a chicken out of it is as difficult to do the first couple of times as starting your own tomato plants.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a challenge.
So you go out and you buy your chicks, and then are people prepared for the fact that these chicks, because I think they think there's going to be this totally sustainable circle where the little baby chicks are just going to eat bugs and weed seeds and fertilize their garden and just be there. But they need heat, water, food, and of course protection. Is that the four basics?
Yeah, for starting out, yep, absolutely. They're used to being under their mother most of the time when they're born naturally, so you have to sort of replicate that environment for the first, you know, about 4 months until they get their real feathers. Yeah, you know, you just have to make sure the temperature is around 95 degrees.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's warm. For the first week, and then you drop the temperature down about 5 degrees every week thereafter until they're sort of acclimated. And like I said, get their real feathers, and then they're ready to go out into the big world.
Most people who are doing this are not going, and I'm just going to broach the subject right away, they're not going to eat these chickens, are they?
Right. Most of the chickens, you know, the eggs are sort of a bonus, but they're pets for most people.
So when is prime egg laying time? Because we get these baby chicks that are just a week or two old, right?
Right. Well, usually they're actually under 3 days old when you get
really?
Them. Really? Yeah, they're very fresh. Prime egg laying time depends on the breed of chicken, but ideally they start laying about 5 months old. And they're productive, really productive, for about the first 2 years.
So they start, let's make it 6 months to make it clean. And the first couple of years, they're going to be in their good production years. But something I've learned from my farmer friends is that it's incredibly seasonal.
Yeah, absolutely. I have 7 laying hens right now, and I was getting about 2 eggs every 3 days from the 7 hens.
But the bounty is now to come.
Correct. February until about, I'd say, early October, they're really pumping out the eggs. I get about 6 or 7 a day from the 7 hens.
Okay, so about an egg a day a bird.
Yep, absolutely.
And is that the norm?
Yeah, that's typical.
Now, in the summertime, let's say you have a situation where you can either build a chicken tractor. And we won't go into that in depth, but people can look it up. It's a protective cage you move with the chickens so that they can eat bugs and weed seeds in a certain area of what will be garden, and they'll poop all over it, and it'll be wonderful. And then you move the cage the next day, and that's the tractor moving. Or let's say they're safe to turn them out into their garden beds. How much of its own food will the average chicken be able to come up with by pecking and scratching and doing what they did in the wild when and wherever they were wild?
Yeah, I would say typically if they're free range and they have access to food and bugs and all sorts of good stuff, they're probably getting about 80% of their diet from nature.
So in the summertime, clean water would be the most important thing you can give them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always have supplemental feed available for them if they choose to. But like I said, in the summertime, they rarely eat it.
And I guess, though, that their food needs go up dramatically over the winter when they're not giving you much in return because they got to keep up their body heat.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely consuming much more supplemental feed in the wintertime.
So you're going to be doing this workshop on Thursday, March 14th, and you're going to have all these newbies, all these wannabes. I mean, we're right at the cusp of chick buying time, right?
Yep, absolutely. Now it's prime time.
What are you going to talk about now after 2 years when these birds start to slow down in their egg production? Is there an old age home for chickens? I mean, do people just eventually just, you know, little chicken walkers, keep them around because they've been there the whole time?
Yeah, I hope people, you know, realize that when they buy a baby chick, it's an investment. You know, you want to keep them for as long as you can. You don't want to be just throwing them at the side of the road and sending them along their way. It's an investment in time, and hopefully people are choosing to keep them for the long haul.
Oh, and you know, you just sparked a thought in my head when you said people buying a baby chick. I can remember when I first started this show, and as back as the editor of Organic Gardening, pre-Easter every year, we would desperately beg people not to buy baby chicks for their children because, you what, 112% of those people were totally unprepared.
Yeah.
And it was a bad end for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So has that practice stopped, hopefully?
You still see it today. I think more so with little baby bunnies than chicks. But, you know, I do encourage people that if they are thinking of purchasing a chick, that they do the research and really think about the process and what it takes to invest in having something like this in your backyard.
You have to have a good coop that has 5 square feet of space per chicken.
Yep. Outdoor space, 5 square feet. Indoor space, 2 to 3 square feet.
And roosts that they can get up on.
Yep, absolutely.
And screening.
Yep.
But it has to be insulated.
Mm-hmm.
And a heater, which I think today's is mostly an ultraviolet light or one of the, not ultraviolet, you know what I mean.
Yeah, infrared heat.
Infrared
light.
Heat.
Yep.
And you need feeders and waterers. So there is a significant investment.
Yes, absolutely.
What will be your egg return on investment, considering maybe you buy, well, I mean, you would have super premium, organic, free range eggs, which are expensive, let's say $4 a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Will you recoup that, or is it like the $600 tomato?
Yeah, it's definitely more like the $600 tomato. You know, I definitely don't use all the eggs they produce, and, you know, I sell a dozen here and a dozen there to friends and or give them away to family, but it's not for the investment in most cases. It's for the enjoyment and the pleasure of having them in your backyard and harvesting your own eggs and making your own omelet out of your own eggs. It's definitely an added bonus and a plus.
All right. We've been talking with Adam Glass, a farmer and gardener at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College. Adam, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Attracting amiable and advantageous amphibians. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's froggy question.
Sure, Mike. Gary in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware writes, back in March, you had a caller on your show who said she was being overrun by toads and frogs and wanted to try and discourage them from hanging around her house. She should be rejoicing at her success. Amphibians in general are having a tough time in our modern environment. According to the United States Geological Survey, they are disappearing at an alarming rate, even from protected habitats, and nobody is quite sure why, my habitat included. The back of my property line is a wetland boundary, and I've noticed that it's gotten a lot quieter out there in the past 10 years. I try to respect the environment, and the property is mostly undisturbed. No mowing, no chemicals, minimal leaf raking. Behind the house is a little decorative pond that is best described as two overgrown puddles with a small circulator pump that runs 24/7 to discourage mosquitoes and attract wildlife. It's the only water in the neighborhood that isn't brackish. In hot weather, it's topped off by the drip water from our air conditioner. But alas, there is no longer a single bullfrog harumphing on summer nights and only a few peepers peeping in the spring. Where have they gone? I miss their cheerful cacophony. P.S. On a trip to Chiapas, Mexico, I learned that the toad is revered by indigenous people as a symbol of new life because in the autumn it disappears into an underground burrow, death, and reemerges in the spring, resurrection. Mike, this man has serious toad and frog envy. Can we help him?
Absolutely. Back in 1994, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we won the first of four consecutive Best of Show awards at the Philadelphia Flower Show for a major exhibit that was dominated by hundreds of different hot pepper plants and ringed with a little runway filled with toads to demonstrate natural pest control. In an article we published the same year, we explained that researchers had found that a single toad can eat tens of thousands of garden pests every season, including grasshoppers, cutworms, slugs, the spruce budworm, the plum curculio, and even cucumber beetles, an insect that tastes so bitter that birds and mantises won't go near them.
So you learned a lot about attracting amphibians.
Yeah, and some of the best and most simplest advice came from Craig Tufts, manager of the Backyard Wildlife Habitat Program for the National Wildlife Federation. He said you need to provide three important things: water, shady shelter, and an absolute absence of pesticides.
Our listener seems to have all three.
Well, it sure seems like he's not using any pesticides. But his, quote, two-puddle pond might be too small if he wants froggies to breed and sing to him in season. A curator at the Oklahoma Museum of Natural History we interviewed for that story stressed that frogs need large, deep bodies of water in which to lay their eggs. And, you know, I just had an experience in Fredericksburg, Virginia that seemed to really prove that point. There is a big retention pond between a hotel I was staying at and the expo center where I was speaking. Very little greenery in the area. Lots of pavement and roadways. But the water was full of spring peepers. Instead of watching TV, I went out and sat by the pond with a glass of wine in the evening. And an expert from the North Carolina Natural Science Museum added that toads don't like to breed in ponds that have pumps or fountains, that it's better to add the non-toxic larvicide BTI to the water to control mosquito breeding.
And third would be those shady spots.
Right. Toads really need deep, dark, wet, shady places to hide in during the day. The ideal toad abode is a little depression you dig in a damp, shady spot that you then place a long, wide board on top of, supported by a few bricks. then cover that board with soil, old carpet, potted plants, whatever. You can even buy pre-made toad houses. Just make sure you place them in full, all-day damp shade.
Right, because if you put them in full sun, they'd be toad microwaves.
And another researcher we interviewed from the Toronto Zoo added that ferns might be the favorite land plant to put in for amphibians. They naturally grow in wet, shady spots, and they provide excellent protection from predators.
Now, it's possible, maybe even likely, that our listener does have toads, but doesn't realize how many because they don't peep or croak like frogs. His environment seems mostly perfect for them.
And toads are mainly active at night. I mostly see mine in my raised beds in the late evening. But if he wants to go for the noisy, froggy gold, he can place a light out by his improved, enlarged, and deepened pond to attract the insects that these amphibians need to breed. Point the light down towards the ground so it doesn't cause light pollution and interfere with stargazing.
If it works, he can go out frog and toad gazing instead.
Well, that sure was some titanic information about terrific toads now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to taunt my toads. If I don't get out of this studio, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy. Please include your location, even if you are certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website flying. Our own Batgirl, Alexis Landis, produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is bird-loving Al Banks. Our associate producer is egg-laying Brett Rader. I'm continuing to enjoy my first real break in 18 years, Mike McGrath. But I'll be back to... Wait a minute. Hold on. Yo, waiter! Another mojito over here, okay? I'll see you again, like, next week. Yeah, over here. Yo, waiter! Sowing seed at the wrong time of year may be the biggest cause of weedy lawns. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal that the timing is now to correct past mistakes and establish a truly weed-proof turf. Plus your fabulous phone calls.